Penguin Random House Audio presents The Fleet at Flood Tide, America at Total War in the Pacific, 1944-1945, by James D. Hornfisher. Read for you by Pete Larkin. There were in morals two requisites for a lawful war, a just cause and the chance of victory. The cause was now, past all question, just. The enemy was exorbitant. Evelyn Waugh, Men-at-Arms, 1952. Preface. Total War. On the morning of June 15, 1944, when swimming tractors carrying four regiments of Marines crabbed over a fringing reef and dropped into the lagoon off Saipan's western shore, the punishment phase of the Pacific War began. 30 months of furious struggle had been the prologue to this, the largest amphibious naval operation to date. Midway had been the stopper, Guadalcanal to Bougainville the first assaults. Tiny Japanese garrisons in the Gilberts and Marshalls fought sharply on strips and curls of coral in early 1944. On Saipan, multiple U.S. divisions went ashore, outnumbered. The terror and nihilism of the ensuing 4 weeks produced a reckoning on a far larger scale. The Battle for the Marianas posed the first major test of the U.S. Pacific Fleet as an integrated transoceanic striking force. Its appearance there drew out the Japanese carrier fleet en masse and provoked the war's greatest naval air engagement, the Battle of the Philippine Sea, as well as a major submarine and air campaign. On Saipan, for the first time in the Central Pacific, U.S. troops faced a large population of civilians, native and Japanese alike. What happened at this unprecedented intersection of cultures would transform the character of the war effort and stand as a rationale for the pitiless strategic air campaign that the United States staged from the Marianas. Japanese soldiers had been demonstrating their preference for death over surrender since 1942, but a deeper madness revealed itself on Saipan, where Americans confronted the horror of civilians, women, children, entire families, leaping to their death from high cliffs into the sea. The Japanese army had terrorized them so thoroughly that they, too, preferred suicide to capture. They blew themselves up with hand grenades and killed their own kids. When the tragedy repeated itself on Tinian and Guam, it was clear that the horror had been no accident of local circumstance. American commanders were quickly alive to the implications of this cruel perfidy. They viewed it as a preview of what awaited them farther to the west. In response, with a subtle cue from their commander-in-chief, they passed a threshold into total war. To force voluntary surrender from a people who would resist to the end entailed the crossing of a moral threshold. The delirious death-chasing of the Japanese in the Marianas so impressed Franklin D. Roosevelt that he authorized release of a statement following a major Allied planning conference in September 1944 that served to condone and perhaps even activate a totalistic and utterly merciless approach to war-making. In the Marianas, for the first time, the Army Air Forces used airdropped napalm on a large scale. Tanks equipped with flamethrowers and infantry squads carrying liquid fire turned Operation Forager, as the invasion of the Marianas was known, into an inferno for the doomed. Once the 20th Air Force had finished transforming the Marianas into nests for its B-29 superfortresses, the Japanese home islands reaped a harvest of ashes. Though the Navy had been wargaming a Central Pacific offensive for decades, the globe-spanning ambition of U.S. Army air power ensured the fleet would come to the Marianas. With Henry Hap Arnold, Curtis LeMay, and Paul Tibbets, among others, eager to strike at the heart of Japan, Douglas MacArthur finally had to cease protesting the Navy's choice of Trans-Pacific routes. The Central Pacific Drive acquired an irreversible momentum as the carriers of Raymond A. Spruance's 5th Fleet under Mark A. Mitcher and Richmond Kelly Turner's amphibious forces delivered this conquest. The powerful triad of naval power, amphibious heavy lift, and strategic air forces opened an air corridor to Japan that would culminate in history's first uses of atomic weapons. The war would have endured beyond 1945 had Saipan, Tinian, and Guam not been taken. This narrative is generally fixed at the level of how things work, following infantry battalions, naval task groups, air squadrons, and other combatants up and down the line, with the goal of illustrating how their power combined in the Marianas to win a hemispheric total war. But a shadow storyline runs in parallel, the story of boundaries being broken at every turn. The question of morality in warfare is vexing. Is there a moral way to kill someone? Is a bullet preferable to starvation? Starvation to incineration? By law or by norm, who is a legitimate target in a war in which one side will not yield? The innocent deserve to stand in the foreground of this picture. When civilians are on the battlefield, what line separates those who may be killed from everyone else? What limits on conduct should be imposed on commanders caught up in a struggle to the death? Should one nation's pattern of conduct in war guide the strategy and tactics of the other side? Afterward, what rights may a conqueror claim, and what tribute may he demand? The moral questions will be left for the reader to answer, but they must be put on the table lucidly, for they arise from any illustration, sufficiently intensive, of the means by which the Marianas were assaulted and defended, and the ends to which they were used. Though this book contains deep portraiture of Japanese civilians who suffered this whirlwind, my treatment crystallizes around three important U.S. line officers whose work gave shape to the endgame of the Pacific War. Raymond Spruance, commander of the 5th Fleet, Kelly Turner, commander of 5th Fleet Amphibious Forces, and Paul Tibbets, founding commander of the world's first atomic striking force. Some readers may quibble that Major General Curtis LeMay deserved Tibbetts' place in this construct, but given that part of my story is the astonishing revolution in weapons technology that was born at Los Alamos and turned loose from the Marianas, the commander who had a hand in developing them and then actually undertook to deliver them, thereby fulfilling the strategic destiny of the Mariana Islands, is rightfully the third leg of this stool. Surrounding these men is a host of others of varied ranks who played important subsidiary roles. Holland Smith, Turner's Corps commander on Saipan and several subsequent campaigns. Mark Mitcher, commander of Task Force 58, the Fast Carrier Force. Draper Kaufman, founder of the underwater demolition teams. David McCampbell, the Navy's leading ace and an important air group leader. And LeMay, the second commander of the 20th Air Force's Marianas-based 21st Bomber Command. Their work brought about the supremacy of U.S. naval aviation, the coming of age of the Marine Corps, the debut of Navy underwater demolition, a byword for today's Navy SEALs, and the aborning atomic age, finally weaponized by a Navy captain who flew with Tibbetts to Hiroshima. Douglas MacArthur, whose messianism vexed the Navy all along, commanded the stage in the end. With his deft handling of the surrender and occupation of Japan, working by, with, and through a defeated emperor, MacArthur, as much as anyone else, shaped the legacy of the war beyond its end. Raymond Spruance had only modest influence at the level of strategic planning. Chester Nimitz, the commander of joint forces in the Pacific Ocean areas, was the driver of the war strategy formulated in Washington. Bespruance.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?